the more that you follow what your gut is telling you to do, the more the universe is going to open up and be like, yes, you're in the flow.
Pinning down Jillian Page into just one title would be an exercise in futility. To paraphrase Walt Whitman, she is vast, she contains multitudes. From her classical voice undergraduate degree and her master's in musical theater, to her love of teaching the Meisner acting technique through an acting program she developed on her own, to her well-established presence as a fitness influencer with, by the way, over 20,000 followers, and as a NASM certified trainer and online coach helping you to gain habits that last, Jillian has seemingly found the things she's loved and thrown her commitment, passion, and desire to connect behind each one. She played Caroline in our short film Screen Test, a fitness influencer who is quote-unquote blowing up and knows it. Jillian brought so many laugh-out-loud moments to Caroline through her spot-on portrayal of this cringe-worthy character, and she is here today with us on the podcast. Jillian, welcome to The Break Breakdown.
Thank you so much, Courtney. What an intro. I feel very good about myself after that. So well,
you should feel good about yourself because those are things that you've done. I know we like kind of started catching up when we just hopped on this call, but I guess before I really launch into anything, I really feel like I need to check in with people. How are you? This is a weird year of quarantine. Just how are you doing?
Well, I feel like in this pandemic, it's a little abrasive to be like, I'm great. So, but I will tell you in confidence, and whoever listens to this podcast, that this quarantine has actually been so formative for me and my life. I'm heartbroken for our country and our world right now. But honestly, Courtney, like this time to reflect and be with myself has been so good for me personally. I think it's really made me face what I'm doing with my time. I'm getting married in October, which is exciting, and my Meisner music business is thriving because I think artists need a community with one another and to explore their art in this time. So it's been really interesting to focus on, wait, I thought I didn't have the time, but now even when I have the time, I'm not pouring it into my artistry and self. So that's been a hard wake-up call, but so wonderful for my life to clear out that which doesn't serve me anymore.
Absolutely. And I feel like I can totally relate to that. I mean, I have had some low lows, but they've all been informative. They've all been helpful, you know, not to say, I mean, the country is experiencing a lot of things that are actually not helpful, but there is that whole thing of, you know, bring something into the light and we can fix it and change it and work with it. And if it's in the darkness, we can't. So
yeah,
I'm glad to hear that. That's
good.
And congratulations to you and your fiance. An exciting time to bring some love into the world.
Oh my Lordy. I know. And I hope, you know, and you're right. I think bringing things into the light politically and with the racism our country has been dealing with, we are going to rise from the ashes, but just, I keep thinking we're at the pinnacle, right? I keep thinking like, this is the last act of violence that I'm going to hear about. And then it's like, really, guys? I mean, we keep doing this. So it's unbelievable, but I do hope for change with that. But yeah, bringing some love with a little wedding here and hopefully love with Meisner Music and the film Screen Test. I'm excited to see it. But yeah, you're right. I think our art is needed now more than ever.
So I wanted to start this conversation off by telling you a conversation that I had with a friend of mine that actually made me think of you when I was preparing for this chat. So a dear friend of mine, we go, you know, back to college together. He, in the past couple of years, has tried to connect me to two different jobs, one in theater and one in politics. And they're completely different, differing skill sets, you know, in one there's dancing and singing, and then the other one there's theater. No, I'm just kidding.
right.
So we were laughing about the fact that he like, at, he's like, you're the only person I know that I could have recommended for both of those jobs. Like, you're like so bizarre. And I was like, yeah, maybe that's why I haven't made it farther in my career, because I keep getting distracted with like shiny new things.
I know.
And he said, you know, we were joking about it, but I, you know, but I was thinking about, in preparing for this, I was thinking about that, because I do think that there is like the light and the dark side of those things. So there are, and I feel like you are someone who really beautifully exemplifies the light side of it, because you've done all of these different things and you've made headway in each area of your career that you've chosen to go down. And my impression of you is that when you find something that really speaks to you, you go all in, you make it yours. So I guess I want to know, is that impression true? Is it accurate? And can you talk about how you have coordinated a variety of careers, from your Meisner in Music class to your own personal acting career to your fitness career, how you've coordinated a variety of pathways into one identity, and in coordinating those careers, any tactics that you've used to make progress in those areas as well?
Yeah, I grew up with a dad who is also a musician, a flute and piccolo player, but I watched this amazing man start so many projects and never finish them. So throughout my life, my friends would come over and be like, oh, are you all remodeling the bathroom? And I'm like, no, it's been like that for years. So he would just so often like strip the carpet and start to stain the wood, but then it would never get done. And I love the man, but it really taught me that I have this impulsive nature in me and also am a perfectionist. So oftentimes I get really jazzed about something, but I must follow through. And I think that's the biggest thing, or one of the biggest things I've learned from my dad. So in that, I went full steam ahead with training in classical voice and theater. And then once I got out of graduate school, I was wanting a day job that was flexible enough that I could still audition. But then I really fell in love with weight training and fitness. I still feel like that's about 20% of who I am. But of course, everyone wants a personal trainer and for someone to just tell them steps to take to get the best health of their lives. So I think fitness actually got a little bit blown out of proportion in my life, because it was much more applicable than performing at the time. It was an incredible section of my life throughout my 20s to be a trainer. But it was interesting how it was something I cared about. But okay, how do I say this for you? It's almost like, because I didn't care that much about it, it blew up, right? Like the things that you're just like, oh, it's fine. I don't really mind what happens with this trajectory. Then the universe is like, and here are the rewards. So, but I think, quote unquote, not caring about fitness also allowed me to have really strict boundaries about the opportunities that I said yes and no to. So, yeah, fitness was something that I cared about, but it was more of like to supplement performing. And then I think I may be projecting this on you, but I feel like I see parallels in our lives where I care a lot about being in one place. I love New York and I love my fiance and my cat and my apartment. So as I'm pursuing fitness and auditioning, I had this gnawing sense that I'm like, I don't really want to go to Florida and do hairspray again. So I'm like, I don't know about this like $300 a week career where I have to leave the things I love. So that's when Meisner Music, well, for a variety of reasons, but that's part of the reason that Meisner Music became such a staple in my life. And this finally, after quarantine, feels like something that I can let go little by little of fitness for and pour myself into more. So I think it's just those three careers have been like, what's serving me right now? And for about 10 years, it was fitness. And performing, it still is. But I think teaching more and more is feeling like, oh, I can be someone who performs but also teaches like this soul-searching work. But yeah, finishing a project and just being like, I'm going to get my NASM certification and then try to be a personal trainer. But I'm also going to audition and then see how that leads me into teaching and being able to perform in one city while also making an income in the arts.
Yeah. You know, we should, when quarantine is up, like actually go out and have a cocktail and trade the war stories of fitness and acting and commingling all of that, because I had a very similar trajectory of, being a performer, but then needing to supplement and supplementing with fitness and getting some degree of success, if you want to, like, whatever, you know, metric you want to use for that. There was some degree of success there, but also being like, I'm really interested in the people that I work with. But from my perspective, I'm not saying this is what you're saying, but I was really interested in the people and I was less interested in what we were doing. You know, I saw the value in it, but I do think, you know, there's something interesting that you're saying, which is like, well, I'm going to just see where this takes me and I'm going to get NASM certified, because I also got NASM certified, but in my brain, I remember at the time it was like $700, something like I couldn't afford. I mean, you know, you pay it over installments, but I remember it being this kind of like, I feel like I need to do this to legitimize myself in the industry, but I'm not all in this industry. And it was like, you know, so I did follow through with it, but I had reservations about following through. So I think it's, you know, I don't really know what to say about that, but it's interesting. I just think like that you can take the same steps and you can take similar actual like external actions, but the inner life of that can be so different. And I don't know if that impacts on, if that has an impact on, you know, what the result is of those external actions, but it's definitely, I feel a lot of people struggle or find it challenging to coordinate like the multi facets of themselves, because we think we need to just define ourselves by one thing. And I feel like for whatever reason, and maybe I'm wrong and please correct me, that you've done that in a really like elegant way of like, yeah, I'm here right now and I'm also open to change and I'm also not beholden to anything but, you know, who I am at a very core level.
Totally. I feel like I have so many things to say to what you just said. But yes, I think the main thing that actually bleeds right into what Meisner is, I swear, Courtney, I feel like Meisner is a way of life disguised as an acting technique. But the idea is that like, okay, well, I'm here right now. So let me just see how this goes. I'm not born to be a personal trainer, but this is the thing that's going to allow me to audition right now and make a lot of money per hour. So let's just go with this. And then now fitness feels sort of like a glove that doesn't fit. And when people are like, oh, Jillian's in the fitness world, I'm like, no. But I was for so long that I'm like, oh yeah, I accept that that's like what I was doing for the last 10 years, but now we're transitioning and that's okay too. I think there's a knee-jerk reaction with Meisner and music where I'm like, oh, but I'm not a teacher. I'm like a performer who happens to teach, but that's okay too. So I think especially performers, but all of us think we have to have this one capitalist thing that we do and that's who we are.
Right.
And it's like, I can make money a variety of ways and I'm still just Jillian. Right, just an air quote. Yeah.
Right. And also I love, like the capitalist idea of you are what you do as opposed to you are who you are. And then you do things. That's really helpful for me to hear even now. So you started going into Meisner a little bit. So tell me about Meisner. Tell me about the principles. You don't have to teach us everything right now, but would love to give our listeners just a little bit of background on that acting technique.
Yeah. So Meisner says that acting is the reality of doing. And I think a lot of times as performers, we think that how we feel is wrong because, oh shoot, it's not how the character is supposed to be feeling. And then it's also hard when we're developing as humans to know what our impulses are. We are born with these core emotions that are truthful and they're unconscious. So as babies and toddlers, we are not in control of what's going on with us, but then we learn what's appropriate in certain situations. And we learn these inhibitory emotions to not overwhelm ourselves with these strong core emotions like sadness, anger, fear. And then we as actors need to actually go back to how we were as toddlers, where we're just impulsive and feeling the feelings all at once. But it feels scary. So Meisner is this amazing technique that teaches us to be with our body and ourselves and just take a breath and be super honest about what we're feeling in the moment. And when I discovered it with text and scenes, I was like, this is amazing. And then I was like, but when I go to sing, and I think I've talked to, I have a lot of dancer students. I think it's similar with dance. When they go to do that, it's like, well, shit, how do I do this really technically challenging thing with my body, but also incorporate the freedom of Meisner, which is act before you think. So yeah, I am just borderline obsessed.
I love it. Also sounds like therapy and mindfulness and like all of those current buzzwords.
Yeah.
No, I love that. I remember doing only a little bit of Meisner in my undergrad. And I think the closest I got to being honest, because definitely at like 19, 20, 21, 22, I was not honest at all.
Right.
Like I was, you know, I mean, at, you know, my mid 30s, I'm not honest, but I remember one time, like my scene partner, like did something, like put his arm around me or did something.
Okay.
I was like uncomfortable.
Perfect.
I was like, that was the most, I was like, the F are you doing? And so anyway, but I remember that moment. I mean, of all the scene study I did, like that moment stuck out to me because it was really uninhibited for me as someone who's generally like trying to smooth things over, make sure everyone feels okay, to be like, here's, it wasn't even like a boundary, right? That's what's interesting about Meisner. It's not like me saying uncomfortable wasn't putting up a boundary and being like, stop. It was actually like more revealing. Like my inner life is unsettled right now because you did that. And I think especially maybe for women and certain groups in our society, we're generally creating that boundary because it's better for people, other people, you know, it's easier on other people. We don't have to defend ourselves in like a, just not even in a physical way, just like an emotional, spiritual way. We don't have to defend what we're feeling. We don't have to defend those things. And that I think is one thing that I've been working on as an adult is like, okay, even the bad feelings, don't like stop labeling them bad. They're just another part of it. Yeah.
Yes. And the feelings that we think are bad are ultimately going to get us to something stronger and braver and in a more healed place. So we have to move through them. The more we avoid them, the further we get from becoming our truest selves.
On your website, you say, Meisner helped me break through the defenses of faux brightness and laughter and find acceptance for all facets of myself, light and dark. So I want you to tell me more about faux brightness, because I think that's just like, I just want you to tell me about it. What does that feel like to you? And then, you know, to your point that you just made, what did having that kind of faux brightness keep you from experiencing?
Well, I'm going to clear my throat really quick. I think you are so right that women especially move through life. Well, we all have, you know, our descriptors, our ways that we move through the world and the reasons that we defend ourselves. But I think women especially are taught to take care of others and make sure that our feelings are secondary to, you know, making sure the room is right. I think that a lot of my upbringing, I learned that comedy and brightness and making people laugh was the way that I could have control over a situation. So when I discovered Meisner, it was right after I was 26 years old, and my boyfriend at the time was diagnosed with cancer. And so I was like, what? And I moved to Texas with him. We were both living in Chicago. We moved to Texas and we got engaged, not in a Walk to Remember sort of way, but in like a, we believe in miracles kind of way. Mm-hmm. And then 11 days after we got married, he passed away relatively suddenly, despite having cancer. So I was just like, okay, we live in Dallas now by ourselves. And
right.
I knew about Meisner a little bit. So I was like, let me throw myself into something new. And I loved it. I was still using laughter and humor to get through a lot of the exercises. And then there's this one exercise called provocative question where you don't answer the question, you just keep saying it. And this woman was doing the exercise with me. And the question for me was, is your life derailed? And I'm like 5 months after losing my, 23-year-old husband. And I'm like, is my life derailed? And I'm laughing and I'm like nodding and I'm using sarcasm to get through it. And then all of a sudden it was like a dam broke within me. And I just broke and was like, ever since, I still struggle with using sarcasm and humor to get through. But it was like this well of emotion that I was like, oh no, this has been living in me and I have not been honoring it. And so Meisner is therapeutic. I cannot say enough good things about it, but it helps us to break through those defenses that can help us, yeah, to not cry in an office meeting when it would be inappropriate, but that in our art doesn't serve us at all. There's no part of us that needs to be protecting ourselves in our art. If we're going to dare to call ourselves artists, we have to be willing to go there.
Right. And I think that's like a really tricky thing for artists is, oh man, it's a profession. But it also like there's no real boundary between who you are as a human and who you are as an artist. It's kind of like one full connected identity. So it does require you, if you want to do a certain kind of work, to do the work as just a human being first, And I imagine, I can visualize you going through that exercise, starting with sarcasm and then moving through it to maybe something that was a little more vulnerable and more to the point of what you were really feeling. And I can imagine watching that and just going on the ride with you as a fellow classmate. And then, because I've been in those circumstances before where you watch someone kind of allow themselves to be undone by a scene or by a moment. And it's so empowering as an audience member to be able to experience that. But as an actor or as an artist, we have to kind of give up our neatness, our inner neatness to be able to offer that to others, not even as a teaching thing, but just like, hey, follow this journey that I'm going to take you on. Maybe it'll help you too,
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Annette Bening has a quote that I can't remember the full quote, but it's so beautiful where she's like, you want your audience members to look at you and be like, that's me. Me too. That's what the quote is. She said, you want your audiences to look at you and go, me too. Right. They're showing my secrets. And so if we're not willing to do that, oh my goodness, and is musical theater prone to this? If we're not willing to go there, what are you doing? Yeah. I feel like it feels to me like a scuba suit where when I go into the real world, I do have to put on my scuba suit to deal with what's going to come at me socially. But then in my art, I have to be willing to take that off and open up the wound.
Yeah. Yeah. So, okay. So this is, again, flawlessly leading through this conversation. So there's this phrase, I'm sure you've heard it, toxic positivity.
Yeah.
It's kind of like in the zeitgeist right now. And it's, if listeners haven't heard of it, toxic positivity kind of refers to this habit of certain folks. And I would say probably on social media or in wellness campaigns or companies or just in general in life, they a habit to encourage their audiences to gloss over either systemic inequities and or personal low moments, and then adopt a mindset instead that says, if I'm just relentlessly positive, then I'll succeed and I'll be okay. Mm-hmm. And like, I think this is partly why I always had kind of a side eye in the fitness industry, because I was like, not everything is just positive. Like, that's right. And so kind of what you're saying about the acting community too is I guess what I'm asking is, you know, is this a hurdle in both the fitness and the acting worlds? How do you see it as a hurdle, this toxic positivity? Do you have any feelings on that, being A, what I would call a pretty positive person, and B, a teacher and a motivator across all of your different careers?
Yeah, I feel like this is so apparent right now with everyone that we're seeing leave the city. And of course, some of the people are leaving for financial reasons and all of that. But I see a lot of friends waking up and being like, wait, I'm not happy in the city. Like, what am I doing there? I need to move to this other regional city where I'm going to be accepted as an artist and be able to thrive fully. And I'm so happy for them. I my heart breaks to lose friends to the, you know, them going to other places. But I think in the artist sense, a lot of us are moving to big cities because we think that's the right thing to do. And we keep auditioning and, you know, working at Starbucks and grinding ourselves to death instead of looking at, wait, I'm not happy here. I need to do some, it's not that I'm just like waking up for 5 a.m. non-equity calls and all is hunky-dory. Like, this sucks. And I think it's taken the pandemic for a lot of people to be like, oh yeah, no. There's not a lot drawing me to New York except for the audition scene, so I gotta go. And I so respect that. But I think that artists need to look at New York and LA aren't the only ways to go. And for me, working regionally is that sort of vagabond lifestyle I don't want. I'm so glad that other people want it so that we have beautiful national tours and everything, but it's not for me. So if we're constantly on this track of positivity, there's no way we're going to find the quiet spaces to really honor what we want and need. Gosh, and the fitness world, I feel like, Courtney, we probably loved it for the same reasons, which is the connection to people and the goodness that it can bring to people's lives. But you're right, with that goodness, there can be a lot of like, oh, just keep going and ignore the messages your body is telling you, and don't eat enough and keep working hard. That can be great and motivating in some senses, but sometimes we just have to sit with like, my body is sending me this message, but for a reason. And if you don't want to go to 5 a.m. call auditions as an artist, there's a reason for that. And that's not to be ignored. So that toxic positivity drowns out so many things that could be keeping us from being as happy as we could be, really. Yeah, so it's like when we listen to the dark stuff, we're actually gonna get to a lighter place as opposed to the toxic positivity, which keeps us probably neutral or maybe less than.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, you describing like being at a call, and it just reminded me. So I wrote a book 5 years ago called The First 10 Years about my time in auditioning and living the, you know, actor's life and thinking about how to be creatively, how to have creative longevity within this kind of system that we're in. And I wrote a little section, I forget where it was, but about sitting in an audition and looking around and feeling like I did not belong there. Yeah. And I just looked at everyone and I was like, I don't belong here. And not like a I'm better than you or I'm worse than you way.
No.
Just, I was like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I know that at the very best of this industry and this career, I'm happy at the very best. But everything else that surrounds it, I don't connect with. And I don't know how to reconcile those two things. And for me, it was a long journey of realizing, A, I didn't actually want to be on Broadway, because right. Like, who doesn't want to be on Broadway, right? But I didn't. I actually didn't want that as I was chasing it. And B, like, I wanted to create my own metrics for success, which generally meant doing my own thing. You know, I generally just want to do what I want to do. So, but that's like really hard to put on like a bumper sticker and say, hi, my name is Courtney and my job is I do what I want to do. Like, people don't understand it. So like, I totally connect with what you're saying on that, you know, if you don't tap into those little secrets that your own brain will whisper to you here and there, you're missing the exit. You know, you're missing the on-ramp. You're missing the way to get to the place that ultimately may bring you a deeper sense of contentment. And I think there is a difference between like being positive and being content, because if you're positive, like, look, you know, you lost someone you love, you know, there is a sadness in that. And the sadness is not bad. It's right. It's life, and life as it stands is not bad. It's just, it's rich, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. which means it's got a high, it's got a low, it's got a boring, it's got an exciting, you know? So yeah, I feel like we could go on and on about this. And what's really interesting is like your character in Screen Test, Caroline, like she is the perfect example of, I don't think when I wrote her, I was thinking toxic positivity, but she's got this thing going on with her. She's got a lot of things. Can you talk a little bit about your character of Caroline in this short film?
Yes. Sweet Caroline, I think cares a lot about the numbers. She cares a lot about, like, I was thinking last night for this podcast, I was like, okay, the word followers is already, are we allowed to curse on here?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. The word followers is already so fucked up. Yes. Like, you're looking at this number and you're like, 20,000 people follow me. And really it could be called subscribers or whatever. But like, I think Caroline really breathes into the thought that her actions and thoughts and words are followed and she is leading people. So I think I think that the positivity gets her through a lot of life. I think this poor girl has been through some dark shit, but she uses the facade that so often we see and breaks my heart, that who I am is not good enough. So I need to be this person with the amount of followers, and not necessarily the quality of life or the quality of people around her. It matters more about quantity and how people are perceiving me, and it must not be how I actually am.
Right. And we talked a lot about, you know, the different filters that each of these characters bring. And she definitely, I would say, has the heaviest filter. Like, I want to do another one where we just like dissect each of these characters one by one, and Caroline, like, just who is Caroline? Who even knows? We can't tell, maybe, in this one.
We need a second film that's just like them all going to therapy individually. Yes. The mockumentary of their therapy session.
Wait, don't put that in my brain. Because
honestly, I would watch that.
No, we would make it. But now I'm like completely, yeah. Wait, I can't even think too hard about that right now, because I'll like actually go into like writing mode. But I think that's brilliant. So a little complicated, like who mm-hmm. she is, but then who she's presenting. So, and also it was, you know, I think I've said this before, but if someone's tuning in for the first time to this podcast, the film that we made was Screen Test. It's a short film and it's mockumentary style. So I'm wondering, Jillian, how you prepared for this role.
I thought a lot about, like I said, it's sort of just cranking up me at my worst. So I don't have 20,000 followers for nothing. Like, there was a period of time where I was putting a lot of work into like following people and engagement, and I was just watching the numbers rise every day, and I was like, wow. And I got addicted to this game of how do you get 20,000 followers. I don't do it anymore, and it's fallen significantly, but I don't mind. But at the time, what was this, like age 27 to 29, I was really into gaining. So I just sort of cranked up the volume on how that felt. It was so exhilarating to see all these people. And then I also kind of used the Meisner technique to, when I learned Caroline's lines, I learned them robotically and just by rote. I mean, Courtney, I know that like this is your podcast and I'm not just blowing smoke up your ass. I love your writing. Your writing is so hard to not know exactly how to say it. But I tried to learn the lines with no inflections and just like a robot so that in the moment, whatever came to me would be impulsive. But, oh, her lines are so juicy. So I just tried to keep her as blank slate as possible as far as what she was feeling in that moment.
Well, thank you. Thank you. And yeah, I feel like Caroline, yeah, it's especially with, I think, maybe stuff that is very present, like we're talking about the fitness industry and we're talking about social media. Like it couldn't be more 2020 unless we had talked about the coronavirus. Like it's just so like right in the pocket. It would be hard, I think, if I were playing Caroline, it would be really hard to not put all of that editorializing on top of it. Which is, I guess, why I'm the writer and the director.
Exactly.
That's what I want to do. But yeah, I mean, dude, when we saw your reel, my husband Craig and I were watching it. It was so funny and so good. And there was so much nuance and presence. And then you were so present in every frame of screen test when we were going through the edit, you know, picking out the shots, it was like, or the takes, you know, there was so much to choose from. And everything just like pop, like you just pop off the screen because you're
thank
so
you.
Present. Yeah. I mean, thank you. And I guess I want to know, I feel like presence is one of those really like, people are ambivalent about that word. I'm sometimes ambivalent about it. I feel like I've spent 15 years meditating on what it means to be present ever since I read, Anna Deavere Smith's book, Letter to a Young Artist. Have you read that book?
No, I have to. That sounds amazing.
Oh, yeah. No. You got to read that. So she has a section on presence. And I remember sitting at an audition at Ripley Greer Studios on 8th Avenue and 38th Street. And I remember reading it and her talking about presence and talking about the story about J-Lo walking down the street and seeing a doorman before the doorman saw her, and he looked up and she just smiled at him, winked, and like said, shh, like don't tell I'm J-Lo. And like that level of presence of like no seeing the world around you, relating to it. And I have been meditating on that story for like 15 years because I think it like just trying to understand what presence really is and what it really means and how it feels and how it doesn't feel. And so I guess I'm asking you, like, I felt like you were so present on the day on set, you like in on screen, you read as present. So how do you relate to presence on and off screen in your own life?
Our brains are just, so there are these five like personality types like in basic psychology, and creatives typically have this one that's called openness to experience. But it's a gift and a curse because we can look at one thing like a brick and see so many uses for it. It's not just a brick to us. It could be like a Barbie doll bed. But the danger in that is that creatives' brains are going a mile a minute, and I'm looking at my piano right now and I'm like, wah, there's like color coming out of it. I want to be looking at something else. And now my brain is going a mile a minute. So as artists, we have to do an extra special job of being like, what is the one thing happening right now? So right. I think that, it's, you know, I don't mean to be a miser freak, but again, Meisner has helped me so much to just be like, what's happening right now? Meditation has helped me a lot with that. Therapy has helped me, but just presence is, I think, checking in with what's the one thing happening in this moment. And with Caroline, there were certainly moments where I was nervous or tense, and so I said, that's what I am right now, instead of fighting it and being like, no, Jillian, just like shake it out. Okay, so Caroline's nervous in this moment, and allowing that to be the character rather than fighting how I feel in that moment. Or if the line's not coming to me, then that's what Caroline's going through. She doesn't know the next thing to say. And then it will usually come once we get out of our own ways.
Oof. That's so hard, but it's one of those things that's so simple, but so difficult, you know?
Yes.
But I think that's true. There have definitely been moments in my life where I've said, like, I'm spinning. I have a lot of anxiety, but what is actually physically happening right yes. now? Like, what is actually happening? Not what's happening in my imagination, you know?
Yeah. And we speak in generalities throughout our lives, and generalities are for people that aren't artists. I think it's great to be like, how are you? I'm fine. But as artists, we have to be really specific, and our bodies help with that. Our bodies always know what's going on with us. So if we feel that spinning, anxious feeling, all we have to do is like pick one body part. Like, what are my fingertips doing right now? And mine right now are buzzing. So that's the kind of specificity that keeps you present. And just like, when your brain tells you, I don't know how I feel, that's a cop out. That's your brain not wanting to choose. Just be specific. And then that kind of hones into the presence that, you're right, is simple, but not easy.
I feel like I want to cry right now.
Oh!
I feel like that is so, first of all, I'll pay you for our therapy session when Great. We get done. And also, like, it's, you know, the phrase, I don't know what I'm feeling. Like, I don't even know how many times I've said that to my husband, my friends, myself. Like, and you're right. Like, that is again, a defense, right? That is a defense from getting mm-hmm. to the bottom of it. And why wouldn't you want to get to the bottom of it? Because you're scared of what it will be, but it's never actually as scary as you imagine it to be. Like, right. Gosh, that was really good. I want to take your class. I'm not even Ooh. Like singing right now, but I would, just to do some Meisner.
I would love that.
Okay, so I feel like this has been a really great exploration of, I feel, where you've started, where you've come to in your career, and I guess what I'm really interested in asking is, what did you misunderstand about acting or about this career, if you want to make it more of a general statement, when you started out? What did you misunderstand when you started out that you understand better now?
I think it's the same thing we've been talking about, which is that I thought, especially going into, well, opera first and then musical theater, I thought that there was one way to go. And I heard, you know, follow your own path and like make your own way. But I was like, no, I'm going to be Renee Fleming. And then when I switch to musical theater, I'm going to be Kelly O'Hara. And that's the path that my life is going to take. And I wish I could tell every artist, but, you know, you have to learn it for yourself, that you can truly make your own way. And if it doesn't feel right to you to do a cruise ship or to work for Disney, you don't have to. And that's not a measure of success. The more that you follow what your gut is telling you to do, the more the universe is going to open up and be like, yes, you're in the flow. But I fought that for a lot. And I'm like you, girlfriend. I thought at auditions, like, I'm like not that interested in being on Broadway and like learning about the new shows on Broadway. I do love Broadway and musical theater, but I'm more interested in truthful storytelling. And that's the way that my life has gone. And that's okay too.
Yeah. 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 A lot of learning how to give ourselves permission for the lives that are trying to be lived through us, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. So this podcast is obviously about the making of Screen Test. But I also, in the title and just in thinking about how this expands past this one project, I've been thinking about, you know, breaking into the industry and the idea of big breaks, and are big breaks a thing anymore? Are they something that we actually give to ourselves? we want to break into something, but we also want to break it down once we get there. We want to shift things around. So I guess I'm wondering, how would you define a big break? And do you think it's something that is given to us or taken by us?
Both. Yes. So when I graduated from graduate school, I had this intuition to move to Dallas, Texas. I didn't know where it was coming from. I had no connections to Dallas whatsoever, but this overwhelming feeling was like, move to Dallas, and I ignored it. I got an agent, I got an apartment and a roommate, and it was all set up. And then the summer before, I was like, no, I'm gonna move to Chicago because I want to. And then, you know, my boyfriend got sick, and where did I move? But Dallas. And so I did need to spend those 2 years in Dallas. I'm not saying I believe in destiny and like you have to follow one road, but Lordy, my life would have been easier if I just listened to that intuition and already had an apartment and a life set up there when he got sick. So then I got a deep intuition. I'd never wanted to live in New York before. And while I was in Dallas, I just read The Alchemist and was like, oh yes, I have to move to New York now. And so I think that big breaks are gut impulses that creator spirit or love or whatever you want to call it gives to us. And that then we have the choice to take or to leave. You know, with the Dallas move, I decided to leave it and still ended up there. So right. Yeah, I have an uncle who is always like, Jillian, I hope you make your big break. And I'm like, no, Uncle Mike, I did. Like, I'm literally living my dream life and I can't wait to see where it continues to go. But to him, a big break is being on Broadway or TV. And I'm still getting there in his mind, but that's okay for him. But I think the big breaks are those deep intuitions that your creative self hears and then you choose to listen to or to not, and they'll come around again, but you know, you make the decisions on which ones to take.
Oh, that is so good. I feel like I'm going to take the next 15 years to meditate on that one. Right. That the big breaks are your gut and your intuition. I love that. So it's funny. So for whatever reason, when I was preparing for this conversation, I kept thinking about head versus the heart, head, heart, head, heart, head, heart. And maybe it was because I was thinking about Meisner and just knowing a little bit about your story and everything. But I remembered this Mary Oliver poem that I love. And is it okay if I read it to you real quick?
Yeah.
Okay. It might not be a poem. Maybe it's more prose, but she's a poet, or she was a poet. So I just call everything a poem. Okay. This is from Mary Oliver. If you suddenly and unexpectedly feel joy, don't hesitate. Give into it. There are plenty of lives and whole towns destroyed or about to be. We are not wise and not very often kind, and much can never be redeemed. Still, life has some possibility left. Perhaps this is its way of fighting back, that sometimes something happens better than all the riches or power in the world. It could be anything, but very likely you notice it in the instant when love begins. Anyway, that's often the case. Anyway, whatever it is, don't be afraid of its plenty. Joy is not made to be a crumb. Which kind of like, she was so great. Kind of builds off of what you were just saying. But my question in context of that is, what does unexpected joy feel like to you, and where do you find it?
It's funny because as you were reading that, I was like, I felt myself settle in my body and just take a breath and be like, yeah, because doing this podcast with you, I mean, just so serendipitously meeting you and doing Caroline, which feels like a tailor-made thing for my skill set. All of this joy, I think I want it and we all want it. But then when we get it, we're like, I don't want to break it, or I don't want to like fully live in it. And I think even now I'm like, yeah, Jillian, this podcast and knowing Courtney is such a gift. And so like lean into that. So I think joy feels like opportunities that are, again, I don't want to say destined. I don't believe in that. That are just so precious that it's beyond words, that come into your life. And so when we take them, it feels like fully giving into them and opening ourselves to them and letting that joy wash over us. Yeah, happenstance meetings, I don't know what you want to call them, but just these incredible little nuggets of life that we have to revel in.
I think that's beautiful and a great way to end. This has been such a great conversation. I feel like I've learned so much. I said this to Sarah last week when we chatted on the podcast, just like so grateful for your work and your, just agreeing to do this short film. And I agree, like, I feel so much joy and so much gratitude for all of the people that have come into this process and feel like just making those connections with all of you and seeing where this goes. I just feel like there's abundance in this world yet. Yeah. There's something good yet. So thank you. And I would love for you to tell people where they can find you online, maybe about your classes, anything. Just tell us where we can find you.
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at the Jillian Page, and it's Page like the name with an I in it. So the Jillian Page. And then also Miser and Music. I post a lot more on Miser and Music about the Miser technique and what's going on with our brains when we're performing and all of that. So yeah, in November, I'm going to take a couple months off right now to get ready to get married in October. And then November 1st, we're starting an online membership where it's going to be like an impulse gym. And you can pay a really affordable fee to just drop into classes as you need them. And I am beyond excited. I think I've been teaching 6-week Miser Music courses, and I think this work has to extend further than 6 weeks. And I'm really excited to be able to offer something that's less intensive than come to a class 3 hours a week, but also is pay what you need to pay and come as much as you need to come. So I'm so excited.
Oh, that's so awesome. That's so awesome. Well, when that started up, if you want to come back on and talk more about it and we can like really dive into it, the invitation stands. So just let
me
know.
Thank you.
Yeah. This has been great, Jillian. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
As always, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. It really helps get the word out about it. And share with a friend if you think someone could benefit from this episode. And thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. Talk to you soon.